By that I mean some financial assistance to meet the obligations and responsibilities of the jurisdiction. Well, I had an apartment on Turk Hill Avenue in Atlanta, and I had called Elder D.D. Gillum to take me to the airport. Elder Gillum came at the appointed time. I came down the stairs and headed for the street. When I got about halfway between my steps and the sidewalk, a soft voice whispered within me, the same voice I heard in 1946. And we crossed that told me I was to be an overseer. Said to me that night, you will be a bishop when you return to Atlanta. I flew on to Detroit, and it was day when I got there. I took a bus, and by guess, intuition, I got off the bus just a few blocks from where Bishop Mason was stopping. He was stopping in the home of Bishop J.S. Bailey. And I was within just a few blocks of where Bishop Mason was stopping. And incidentally, as I walked toward the house, I heard someone call and I looked around. It was a young lady whom I had married, she and her husband, some years before. I went on to the home of Bishop Bailey, and there I found Bishop, who became Bishop W. L. Morris, or W. M. Morris, it might have been, and Bishop Williams, who was then chairman of the Elders of Wisconsin. And Bishop Williams, he is now, was there with a petition from the elders of that state that Bishop Mason would make and ordain Bishop Morris to the bishopric. Bishop C.L. Anderson Sr. came over and conferred with Dad, and he ordained and consecrated Morris as a bishop. Then Bishop Anderson said to Bishop Mason, Dad, here's a man from Georgia that has been loyal and faithful to the church and to God, and I think he should be consecrated as a bishop of the church. We need men like Overseer Dale. And Bishop Mason took me down by his knees. I bowed upon on my knees, with my elbows on his lap, and there he prayed and consecrated me to the bishopric of the church. Of course, he had done this informally 2 years earlier. Yes, 2 years earlier, the day that he consecrated Bishop W.G. Shipman as a bishop of the church, he laid his right hand on Bishop Shipman's head and his left hand on my head, and prayed a prayer of consecration, though he did not tell me that I was a bishop of the church. He did, however, formally consecrate me on October the 15th, 1954. I returned to Georgia, not just Overseer Dale, but Bishop Dale. Not simply appointed a bishop, but consecrated to the bishopric. Not simply named the bishop, but with the consecration of the greatest man on earth to us, to me, and to thousands of others who knew him, that founding father, Bishop Charles Harrison Mason. Some of the young men of Georgia of Northern Georgia in particular gave me a reception, and they attempted to give me a testimonial dinner. But those who were a little higher up, at least some of those who were higher up on the ladder and who held the reins in their hand, were able to minimize the occasion. But though they minimized it, to me it was a wonderful occasion, and I thank God for it today. This was in 1954. No, it was in that same year that there was an effort on the part of some whose names I will not record in history at this time, but it happened to be my predecessor who came back to Georgia and told them that I had spent $675 of the state's money and that Bishop Mason had taken me down as bishop. It was planned that Bishop McEwen would come to Atlanta to investigate the charges. Ella Pullins and I always stayed together when we went to Memphis. So during that Memphis convocation, after these charges had been made, early one morning about 5 o'clock, God gave me directions as to what to do, because it was my feeling that the man whom I just named was inclined to favor my predecessor. So I got up early that morning, as God directed me to do, went to Bishop Mason's office along and took Ella Pullins along with me, and asked Bishop Mason if he wouldn't let the bishops of Georgia look into that situation. And he thought that was a fine thing to do, and he had me to type a statement, and he signed that statement that the bishops of Georgia would look into the charges that had been placed against me, and that we would report to him their findings in April. I knew that I would not be able to slug it out with the man who was to come, but I knew too that I could slug it out with anybody in Georgia. So we set a meeting, and the gentleman who was involved, Bishop Winey was one of them, and Bishop Hendley, would not agree to hold a meeting in Columbus, because they felt that I had influence there. I would not agree to hold a meeting in Atlanta, because Atlanta was the base of these unscrupulous and ungodly charges. So we agreed to hold a meeting in Macon at Bishop Wining's church, and the predecessor suggested that his superintendents, and I objected to that, because no superintendents were involved in Northern Georgia except the superintendents of Northern Georgia. However, we did agree that Bishop Wining's assistant, Bishop E.W. Strickland, and his secretary, or a close man to him, the now presiding bishop of Southern Georgia, Bishop C.J. Hicks. And there, I was confronted with this charge. There I was told, there the men were told, that I had no jurisdiction, that if the men wanted me, I would have a jurisdiction. And there he reiterated the story that I had misappropriated $675, which was not true. But anyway, they talked and discussed, and finally Bishop Strickland said, "Now, brothers, we have discussed this long enough. Why don't we let these men vote?" And it would seem that there was a kind of satisfaction among my colleagues that in case Northern Georgia collapsed, suddenly Southern Georgia and Central Georgia would benefit by it. Anyway, there were the superintendents who numbered seven, and the seven were Superintendent F.W. Rhodes, Superintendent George Briley, Superintendent Corris Pullen, Superintendent J.B. Willis, Superintendent C. Woods, and maybe there were two that were not there. Anyway, the men that were there voted 5-2 that they would stand by me as Bishop of Northern Georgia, that they didn't believe the report, that it had not been proven, that it was simply a statement, and that there were no records in Memphis to show that I had made any misappropriation whatever. And so there were two men who said, "No, we will not work with Bishop Dell." And the meeting closed. This was in December of 1954. Early in perhaps January of 1955, I called a meeting at Perry, and it was there that a very strong man argued that, I don't remember the argument. Anyway, it was not a fair and favorable one, because 16 men had signed the petition asking the Bishop Mason to send a committee to Georgia to investigate the financial affairs. Anyway, that night, as this gentleman and I sat side by side, I slapped him on the knee and called his name and said, "Now, you know and I know that 16 men don't come together and put their signature to any kind of proposition without somebody guiding them and directing them. I further said, now you know and I know that if you and I could get together, this problem would be solved. And I know this and you know this. You know that you are the power behind the throne here." Meanwhile, I had written this gentleman 3 letters. And each time I wrote him a letter asking him what was the problem, and if I knew what the problem was, I would attempt to solve it. That I did not know what the problem was, each time I wrote him a letter, I sent copies of that letter to Bishop Mason and Bishop Shipman and Bishop McEwen. Then when I would write the next letter, I would say, "Now, I don't know whether you got my letter or not, but I received no reply." And then I reiterated and restated what I'd stated in the previous letter. I did this 3 times. Then I was through. Well, in the workers' meeting that year, which convened at in Columbus, the meeting convened in Columbus, I called this brother to my bedside and discussed with him the facts again, that he knew that he was the power behind the throne, and why not we get together? And we discussed getting together. So in the council the next day, when this brother went out for some cause, I said to the men of the council, said, "This brother, this is a good man, but the man has been sick for quite some time, and why don't would you all accept me, appointing him as my assistant? When he came back in, I named him, said, Brother Briley, I have decided that I need you to help me, and I want you as my assistant. The men applauded, and he accepted. And, of course, from that day, things were better. This was in the worker meeting of 1955. And I think that that decision and that meeting was a great victory, not for me alone, but for all of us, because it suddenly dismissed the feeling that had existed, and it cooled the heat of the fires that had been kindled, and it changed the course of the history of Northern Georgia. It changed the attitude of many people, and it strengthened the support and influence of the man who had so recently been consecrated to the bishop of the church, and the peace of God began prevailing again. This was in the workers' meeting of 1955 at Columbus, Georgia. It was in that meeting that I appointed Elder F.W. Rhodes as pastor of the church at Calhoun. The convocation of 1955 convened at the first church, which had been made headquarters of Northern Georgia. And it was a smoother and more progressive convocation than we had had in the past. Elder J.P. Phelps had appointed him state secretary, and Elder J.W. White was the treasurer whom I had appointed. Elder White was then the oldest minister in point of service in Georgia anywhere, and was one of the older men of the church. He had pastored smaller churches like Villa Rica and Lithia Springs down through the years. In fact, I had appointed him pastor. So the 1955 convocation, and then Elder David Jackson had succeeded him at Lithia Springs. So the 1945 convocation was a relatively and comparatively wonderful experience, that there were few problems, very few, very little conflict, and the Lord blessed us in that in that convocation at the First Church. When we went to the General Convocation at Memphis, which began on November the 20th and closed on December the 15th, always, but this particular year, before leaving the convocation, I learned that the presiding bishop of Central Georgia had planned to hold their workers' meeting at Dublin. Meanwhile, we had selected Dublin as a location for our 1956 workers' meeting. So I went to the bishop and had informed him that we had already selected to hold our workers' meeting at Dublin, and gave him the date of our workers' meeting, which was the same date they had selected. So he didn't say anything, but they did change the meeting and moved it 1 week ahead of our meeting. Our workers' meeting always closed the third Sunday in March, and so they set that one to close the second Sunday in March. Well, I didn't know how well this was going to work, but there was a strong feeling among the people of Northern Georgia. And, of course, since it had been circulated that I had misappropriated $675, and this had been proven incorrect. The people of Northern Georgia had a little misgiving about the workers' meeting of Central Georgia coming to Dublin, where they didn't, they had only one church, and it was then under construction. Anyway, the meeting came, and all of the people of Northern Georgia felt that I should not attend that meeting, neither did any of them. Unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case might have been, Central Georgia didn't have a single church nearer than 150 miles, except the one congregation in Dublin. And this made it rather difficult for them to have any kind of attendance worthwhile. The working meeting had been blown up, and it had been publicized by radio and by handbills and what have you. Anyway, one of the businessmen of Dublin said to me, "Aren't you, you think your meeting is going to be successful?" I told him I thought it would. Anyway, after the close of the central meeting on the second Sunday in March, the Northern Georgia convocation began Monday after the second Sunday in March. And the Lord blessed us. That was one of the greatest workers' meetings we had ever had. It was really a turning point in the history of Northern Georgia. It was a very favorable turning point because on Thursday before, the bishop had come to my house and suggested that we should work together, that they would like to have me come. But I advised him that I couldn't well do that, because if I did, I would encounter and maybe have the ill will of the people I had to live with, and that they felt that I shouldn't go, and I certainly wouldn't want to frustrate them, and he admitted that that was right. Anyway, the next week, we had the worker meeting, and what is now known as Zion Hope Church, located on Alabama Street, and that's a large church with a large seating capacity. The Lord blessed us, and we didn't have room for the people. The cars were lined up for blocks, and it was one great meeting. I remember one of the old deacons of the church, Father Denson O'Neill. He wasn't old enough to be called Father at that time, but Father Denson O'Neill sat about halfway to church, and on that Saturday or Sunday, he said, "This is it. This is it." The Lord so wonderfully blessed us in that meeting, and all glory be to God. From that time forth, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that Northern Georgia would exist, that it would continue to make progress, that it would continue to grow, that the men had accepted the leadership of their bishop and overseer, that they were working with him, that they would work with him, and that, again, Northern Georgia would succeed. For that, we are very grateful. This was workers' meeting of 1956 at Dublin. By then, it seemed to be certain that the Lord had established his servant as a leader that could survive the storm, that could survive the severest attacks and the most damaging accusations that could be thrown at one, and that the men and workers of Northern Georgia had accepted him as their leader, that they respected him. They respected his judgment. They were willing to accept his program. They were willing to follow his leadership. They were ready to go to bat for him. And this was proven without any shadow of doubt in that workers' meeting
at Dublin in the year 1956. So we did not leave that meeting as victims, but we left it as those whom the Lord had given the faith that is the victory that overcomes the world, the victory that can move mountains, the victory that can survive storms, the victory that will ultimately take us into God's eternal kingdom when the span of time will have ended. In 1956, the convocation was transferred from the First Church in Atlanta to the Jones Avenue Church in Atlanta. And this, again, was a very successful convocation. There might have remained some trace of former conditions, but they always remain under the surface. They could never really surface. They had been erased so far as the surface were concerned, and the convocation was a very acceptable and glorious one for 1956. However, because of the illness of my wife, and because I lived 150 miles from Atlanta, and because the First Church was the mother church, but the membership had declined in previous years, and each of the other leaders, Brother Brown and Brother Hensley, had radio programs and were well established in Atlanta, among all of the churches in that city, the saints, I found it difficult to survive. So in 1957, the Lord told me to leave Atlanta and go to Albany and become a father of his people. Of course, the workers' meeting of 1957 convened in Columbus. Now, Columbus had more workers' meetings than any other city in Georgia, until we established a headquarters in Atlanta. The 1957 workers' meeting was smooth and it was relatively good. But in 1957, during the convocation, the Lord spoke to me and directed that I should go to Albany and be a father for his people. The pastor of that church had taken ill then, and was not able to function. So I went to Albany and became his assistant in the month of September. I did not take one nickel, not one penny, of his pastoral money, which ran about $30 to $35 every other Sunday. I would go to Albany on the odd Sundays, and maybe they would give me $8 or $10 that Sunday, and I'd stay over until Tuesday night and Wednesday night, and the Lord would bless. So I did that from September through December. In the month of December, the Lord took him, and then I took over the pastorate of the Monroe Street Church. I believe it was the first Sunday in January, or maybe the fifth Sunday in December of 1957. In January of 1958, I secured a contract with TV station WALB and telecast the services of that church from January 1958 through January 1959, twice each month. And of course, I had to take Friday mornings. I believe it was maybe 9:45 to 10 o'clock on Friday morning. That is, every other Friday morning, unless there was a fifth Sunday, the Friday before the first and third Sundays in each month, I would appear on television with the hour of prayer, and this for a year. At the close of that telecasting, I secured a contract with WJAZ Radio, and that was in 1959 that I went on the air at Albany over WJAZ. And of course, it is now 1978, and the Monroe Street Church is still on the air every Sunday morning. Now, we went on the air in 1959 with a tape recorded program, that we would record the program on Sunday morning, and then it would play it the next Sunday morning from 7:30 to 8 o'clock. This continued for at least about 4 or 5 years. Anyway, the 1957 worker meeting was at, or convocation rather, the 1957 convocation convened at the Jones Avenue Church in Atlanta, as previously stated. The 1958 workers' meeting also was held at Columbus. It was a great and successful meeting. We held it on the Sunday in the Messiah Hall because it was larger. We had more room. We could use the kitchen. We could use the concessions. And on Sunday, we held a worker meeting of 1958 at the Columbus Church, and on Sunday in the Masonic Hall. And the convocation of 1958 was held at Jones Avenue. In 1959, we took the workers' meeting back to Dublin. Of course, at this time, there was only one workers' meeting in Dublin. That was Northern Georgia. And in 59, that workers' meeting was a great and glorious workers' meeting. The convocation of 1959 was normal and peaceful, and the Lord blessed and added to the church. In the year 1960, we took the workers' meeting to Perry. We took the workers' meeting to Perry, and we had in the workers' meeting that year Bishop L.C. Patrick, who was the superintendent, the international superintendent of Sunday School of the Church of God in Christ. We also had Bishop Hensley with us that year, and he preached, as did Bishop Patrick. It was a wonderful meeting, and there were no great changes. I believe we did charter a bus from Albany to Perry, and carried our children, our young people, and our adults to that meeting. This was in 1960, and the convocation of 1960, well, was at the settled place in Jones Avenue. In 1960, during the general convocation of 1960, Bishop F.W. Wining passed, and we left the convocation and drove to Macon to be there for the day of the funeral, which was done by Bishop O.M. Kelly. The executive board had sent Bishop Kelly, well, I say the executive board, it was not called the executive board, it was called the special commissioners. The commissioners had sent Bishop Kelly to install Bishop E.W. Strickland as bishop of Southern Georgia. That was in 1960. In 1961, something happened to me that seemed to be tragic. The Lord took my wife, Mrs. Della Dell, the mother of all my children, the mother of the only children that I've ever fathered in the world anywhere. The Lord took her on February the 9th, 1961. Following the 1959 convocation, I had taken her and two of our grandchildren to Hartford, Connecticut. I had left Dublin at 2 o'clock on Friday, I believe, and she wouldn't agree to stop at a motel, so I'd driven all night, and we got to Richmond, Virginia the next morning. We couldn't make the fast time cars can make now because you had only two lane highways, except a few stretches of four lane, and in South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, and Maryland, the speed limit was 55 miles an hour. In some of those areas, they meant 55. Anyway, I drove into Hartford at 6 o'clock that Saturday afternoon. And when the time came to return home, I left my wife and the grandchildren and drove back home alone. It was a sort of sad party. Anyway, she remained there until November, I believe. From September, she stayed there all of October. And in November, of course, she returned. And I saw her hopes fading. She felt that if she could get to Philadelphia, rather to Hartford, where Walita was, she would get better. Well, for a little while, she did seem to be better. But that didn't last. So then she began to feel if she could get back to Dublin, where I was, she would get better. And I met her in Savannah and brought her home, put her to bed, and cooked every meal she ate for a solid week. Anyway, in 1961, on February the 9th, the Lord took her. She passed suddenly, sitting in a chair, laughing and talking with our daughter and grandson. They walked out to get in the car to drive up to Helen's home, which is my daughter, and before they got in the car, she died sitting in a chair. This was in February of 1961. We buried her on the 14th of February. Now, she passed on Thursday. We buried her on Tuesday of 1961. In the meanwhile, the Sunday School Convention had been requested for Atlanta by the Bishop of Central Georgia, and none of us knew this until we got to Memphis and saw it on the wall. So that was an effort then. We buried my wife on Tuesday, and a meeting had been called for the following Monday to try to get the Southern Georgia and Northern Georgia jurisdictions to help to sponsor that Sunday School convention, which we felt reluctant to do because we had no input into inviting it there, and we knew that the person who invited the convention would get all of the praise and all of the glory and all of anything else that comes out of a convention. So we were very reluctant to support it. In fact, we supported only to the extent that it was binding upon us to support. This was 1961. Well, in 1961, we held our working meeting down at Millen. And on the women's day of that meeting, they sang a song that was a favorite of my wife, and I could not take it. I burst into tears and left the church and went to my room and stayed the remainder of the day, because that song was "Just Think of His Goodness to You," and I was not able to take it. I did go back to church that night, but this had some effect on me for the remainder of the meeting. It was a very good meeting, however. Never had there been a meeting of that dimension in that area, and the people of Millen and Jenkins County and that part of Georgia were just elated and delighted. In fact, I'd gone to the radio station and broadcast the services, and it was simply great and wonderful and exciting. That was 1961. the convocation of 1961 was at the Jones Avenue Church, as we had always done. In November of 1961, I came down with meningitis. I was stopping with Mother Louvenia Mitchell in Albany, and on the fourth Sunday, I believe, and now, or it might have been the second Sunday in November, I don't remember now, that I came down with meningitis on Sunday night. It was Monday afternoon, but, well, I said Sunday night, which was the close of my anniversary. They'd given me $400, and I couldn't get out Monday at all. Someone deposited that money for me, and Mrs. Carrie Clark and missionary McCreary took me to Bainbridge to the hospital that Monday afternoon. And I was in the hospital there for maybe 2 weeks under the care of Dr. Griffin. And I knew I had meningitis because some years before, one of the members of the Christian Church I pastored came down with meningitis. And I took sick just like she did. I suffered just like she suffered. And I was at her home when they took, the ambulance came and took her away to the hospital. I was there. So I knew then that I had meningitis. I told Dr. Griffin I had meningitis. Dr. Griffin didn't tell me I didn't. He said, well, Reverend Dale, that shows that you are thinking. And a thinking man may think most anything. This confirmed the fact that I had meningitis, because if I did not have meningitis, he would have told me, no, you don't have meningitis. Anyway, the Lord blessed me to survive that attack of meningitis. I came out of the hospital and maybe stayed in for a week, drove to Atlanta, and left my car, I believe, with Mother Bivens and Brother Tommy, and went on to Memphis. And I was so weak. I went to Memphis to attend the general convocation and the funeral of Bishop Mason. Bishop Mason had passed on the 17th of November, and they had his eulogy during the convocation. I sat through that funeral for 6 hours. I'd been out of the hospital maybe for 10 days with meningitis. And that night after the funeral, someone took my hat the next morning with the degree down to 29. I got a cab and went to the railroad station and took a train out to St. Louis, where my son and daughter-in-law met me and took me to their home and put me to bed and cared for me for a week. And then it was time for me to go back to Memphis and perform my duties as secretary of the General Elders Council. The Lord blessed me to live through that and go through that meeting and survive and succeed in getting back home. In 1962, the workers' meeting convened again at Columbus, Georgia. I remember some of the events of that meeting. I remember Mother Bertha Gillum saying, I believe it was on Women's Day, that they would like to see me get married, that I had held myself up, that I had kept myself neatly, looking neat, and what have you. And they wanted so much then that the Lord would give me a wife. Of course, I had a person in mind for a wife, but it was not the will of the Lord, and it did not work out. I remember, too, that Elder Briley got up in that meeting and said he didn't see how I could make it without a wife. And then he said humorously that he hoped I would marry because maybe I wouldn't be so grouchy And we had a lot of fun about me being grouchy. Anyway, the meeting was a success. It was a great and a glorious meeting. It was in April that a brother, Otha Kinsey, who was saved under my ministry at Soperton many years before, drove down from Philadelphia, and I decided to ride back with him. I did. And there was a lady in Philadelphia whose name was Macy Johnson that loved my mother and kept in touch with my mother. So we got to my mother's house. It must have been Tuesday evening, and maybe Wednesday. We started talking about, and my mother mentioned Macy. While we were talking about Macy, the Lord spoke to me and told me that she was the woman for me to marry. I called her home. She was in Washington, D.C., attending the women's convention. After the close of the 1949 working meeting at Columbus, Otha Bryant accompanied me to a temporary home I had in Bainbridge, where we spent maybe a couple of nights, and then we went on to Douglas to the working meeting of Southern Georgia. And that working meeting of Southern Georgia, at least following that working meeting of Southern Georgia, I had an experience that I shall never forget. I was there maybe Tuesday night, and Wednesday I went home, and Thursday or Friday, I believe it was, I came back to Douglas on the bus, and I stopped at the bus station where we had 30 minutes layover. I walked down the street thinking maybe I might see some of the brethren, which I didn't. Incidentally, one of the brethren saw me because I went in the attention store to get something I liked. And he saw me there, and he decided that I hadn't left Bainbridge, rather Douglas, that I had been there all the time someplace. And he put out a terrible rumor, a very damaging rumor, but thank God that I was able to survive it. I went on to Bainbridge without even seeing him. In August of 1949, we held the state convocation at the Jones Avenue Church, located at 591 Jones Avenue in the city of Atlanta. The Jones Avenue Church became the temporary headquarters for the Northern Georgia jurisdiction for quite some time. I think it was in that convocation that I appointed Ella C. Pullins as superintendent of the Athens district that Elder J.P. Phelps had resigned to accept the secretaryship and the superintendency of the Sunday School for Northern Georgia. This is about the outstanding achievements of the year 1949. In March of 1950, we held a worker meeting in the town in which I lived, Dublin, Georgia. The Lord blessed us in that meeting. Bishop Mason attended that meeting. As a matter of fact, we owed him a large sum of money, and he came by to see if we had his money or how we would be able to get his money. This money, of course, was owed on the Rockwell Street property,
$10,000 that they, or rather $7,000, not 10, it was $7,000 they had borrowed from him, at least my predecessor had borrowed from Bishop Mason, trying to carry through on that temple that they had started there. Whoever might have been instrumental in borrowing the money, it was invested in that temple, and we owed it. So we gave Dad a portion of that money from the workers' meeting and promised to pay the rest. This was in 1950. It was in that year that I bought an automobile, and I bought it while Dad was there, and I took him around the city and showed him Dublin and the areas around Dublin, and of course, as usual, he enjoyed sightseeing. He left, and the workers' meeting was, to that extent, a success. From that workers' meeting, I went to Douglas the following week, where the South Georgia workers' meeting was in progress. I was pastoring the church at Bainbridge then, and therefore I went, had to go to Tifton anyway, so I spent a couple of nights at Tifton with my brethren. We had been so recently separated into two jurisdictions, and so we could hardly do without seeing each other, and we missed each other so much in our convocations and workers' meetings. So it was to me a kind of reunion of a great family, and I enjoyed the stay at Tifton for the workers' meeting there in 1950. Elder F.W. Rhodes, who had come to Northern Georgia in 1949, who had, of course, no church appointment at all, I took him at Bainbridge and made him an assistant there. I was there only two Sundays, and I gave him the other two Sundays so that he would have some income and that I could take a good look at him, that I might know exactly what his true characteristics and ministry were. Well, that was in 1950 that I gave him this assignment. Also, the convocation convened at the Jones Avenue Church in Atlanta in 1950. That was in August, as always. I drove from Bainbridge, a distance of 235 miles, to Atlanta to the convocation so that I could open the convocation officially and prayerfully at 10 a.m. When I arrived at the Jones Avenue Church, the church was locked, and I did not know where the key was. However, I inquired by telephone and otherwise till I was able to locate a key to the door. And there, I opened the convocation on my knees before God with Mother Mary McIntyre, who had gone along with me, and a young lady by the name of Remail Collier. So Mother McIntyre, Sister Collier, and another old minister who was a retired soldier from the Army, Elder Albert, opened the convocation. We spent perhaps 2 hours on our knees before God in the opening session of the convocation. This impressed Elder Albert greatly, to see a man drive 235 miles and then spend 2 hours in prayer with only the people who came with him, made a great impression upon Elder Albert, and he then associated himself with the Churches of God in Christ of Northern Georgia. He became an ardent supporter and a very dear friend to me, and I shall always remember that occasion. This was perhaps the highlight of my life in 1950, the attending of the calling of the workers' meeting to my hometown, Dublin,
to have Bishop Mason come to that meeting in my hometown and to visit my home, to pray in my home, to ride with me around Dublin, sightseeing the small town, the VA hospital, and what few points of interest there were, was indeed one of the highlights of my life. I had always dreamed of, in my mind, of driving Bishop Mason around town. I had always wanted to have him come into my home. And so this 1950 gave me that opportunity. It gave me that chance. And be sure that I was very, very happy. Now, one other thing happened in 1950. I believe it was during the convocation of 1950 that by then I believe we had sold the property that the former temple foundation had been laid upon by my predecessor. And we owed Dad $6,700. So we had sold that property. And during the convocation, the brethren put me on a plane, and I flew to Detroit, Michigan, where I took Dad the check. Or rather, it was not Detroit, Michigan. I believe it was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yes, I went on the train, I believe, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and flew back from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, during the convocation. This was my first experience of flying to where Bishop Mason was in a convocation. One other thing happened in Pittsburgh that I cherish the memory of, and that is a deacon, John Davis, that I had known in Macon, Georgia, for a number of years, who had left Macon and gone to Pittsburgh. As a matter of fact, when I attempted to go north in 1926, I had planned to go into Pittsburgh where Brother John Davis was. Brother Davis was not at church the night I went to Pittsburgh, and so he learned that I was there, and the next morning he got up early and walked the number of blocks necessary to come where I was, and he came into my room. He was one happy man because he had been my Sunday school teacher when I was in my late teens. He was a deacon of the church when my pastor appointed the teenager as his assistant. He guided me and directed me and instructed me and helped me during the time that before he left Macon. So he wept with joy. Yes, tears of joy came down his cheek as he prayed with me and thanked God that I had reached the overseership and that his teaching and his labors and the efforts he had made in my behalf were not in vain. Oh, it was a happy meeting, and I was so happy to put my arms around Brother Davis, who was then getting up in years, and there to thank God and thank him for the counsel he had given me, for the guidance he had then afforded me, and for the love he'd shown me. This was one of the highlights of my life in the year of 1950. I went out to Pittsburgh on the train. It took 27 hours, and God bless me, to fly back in 3 hours and 45 minutes. I remember on that flight, too, that we encountered some turbulent weather. There was a gentleman on that flight that got airsick and had to have the attendant of the stewardesses. This was quite an experience for me. I had never flown in turbulent air before. And, of course, turbulence isn't so bad with jets because they travel so fast. But with the conventional propeller planes, turbulence can be pretty rough. And so during that turbulent period and area,
God blessed me that I did not get airsick, as did some other of the passengers. Well, I returned to Atlanta, and it was a glorious returning. Our convocation was successful. God blessed us marvelously, and for that, I'm very grateful to God. This was, as I recall, the high points of my life and experience in the year of 1950. There was an experience in 1950, however, that I had overlooked. I came down with laryngitis in perhaps June of 1950. My son was just out of school, high school that is, and he came to Bainbridge. I had to go to the hospital on Sunday night after church. This was in Bainbridge, where for the time I was living temporarily. I felt the results of the laryngitis maybe on Thursday or Friday. And Dr. Joseph H. Griffin was my family physician. He was out of town at the time, so I went to another doctor who gave me a shot and felt that I would be all right. Dr. Griffin came Saturday. I went to him, and he also gave me a shot and thought I would be all right. But by Sunday night, the condition had worsened, and he ordered me to the hospital. My son Nathan came to, you can't believe he came that Sunday night while I was at church. When I went to the house, I found him sitting on the porch. I went on to the hospital, and the following Saturday morning, I asked him to go and do the radio program for me, which I was doing every Saturday morning. And it was then that I discovered that the Lord had called him to the ministry. He did that program, and I remember his subject was, "Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth." Being just out of high school, I thought he did a marvelous job in preparing and delivering a radio message, something he had never done before. This was an experience I had in 1950. Also that year, I sent Nathan, my son, one of the twins, incidentally, to Savannah State College, where he finished in 4 years. Back to 1950, one of the reasons that I think that I came down with laryngitis was we were building the church at Bainbridge, and I just simply overworked myself. My family was not there, and I was busy pouring the steps and doing different chores, and I would have breakfast maybe at 8 o'clock in the morning. It would be at 4 o'clock sometime in the afternoon before I would get anything else to eat, working in the concrete, making my own mortar, sitting their own farms, pouring the steps, and I simply overworked, and I came down. But thank God that he blessed me to survive. I remember that Nathan returned from Savannah State to Bainbridge just before Christmas. And Christmas of 1950, Christmas Day came on Monday. So Sunday was Christmas Eve day. We went through the services on Sunday and Sunday night. About midnight that Sunday night, we left Bainbridge for Dublin. It was one of the most beautiful nights I'd ever seen in my life. It was a full moon. The moon was shining brightly, although it was cold, but the moon was shining brightly and beautifully. Yes, we left Bainbridge about midnight,
and arrived home about 4 o'clock in the morning. On Monday morning, Christmas morning. Shortly after we left Bainbridge, I turned my radio to station WCKY out of Cincinnati, and someone was playing the Christmas carols on that station. They would introduce the carol, tell when it was written and by whom, and under what circumstances. So they played all of the popular Christmas carols, introducing them one by one. When they had introduced them, then they played them around and around, over and over again, all night. That is an experience that I have never forgotten, and hope that I never will. All night from 12 o'clock, or about 12:30 maybe, until 4 o'clock in the morning, we listened to the Christmas carols. Silent night, O holy night, O little town of Bethlehem, the first Noel, and many other of the old favorite Christmas carols. We listened to them from about 12:30 until we arrived home at 4 o'clock on Christmas morning. Another unique experience of 1950, Elder E.T. McGriff, whom I had appointed pastor of the church at Columbus maybe a year and a half earlier, resigned that church, and I felt led to take it over as pastor. So I became the minister of the Winton Road Church, located at 1112 Winton Road in Columbus, in the year of 1950. I remained as pastor of that church until 1954. It was in 1950, as I've said, that my son Nathan went to Savannah State College and returned just before Christmas. We spent the Christmas of 1950 at Dublin at home with my family.
He was a Baptist.
In the early part of 1951, I succeeded in getting a contract with WDAK in Columbus to broadcast directly from the Winton Road Church every Sunday morning. I believe it was 11:15 to 11:30. And of course at that time that broadcast only cost us $13 a week. So every Sunday morning at 11:15 we went on the air directly from the church on Winton Road, known as the Winton Road Church of God in Christ. Now, that broadcast we carried on as long as I was there until 1954. Because there was a young man attending school, at Tuskegee, Alabama, named Robert Smith. Robert's parents were not financially wealthy people, and Robert needed assistance. So I gave him 2 Sundays to preach, and I would preach 2 Sundays. That is, on the first and third Sundays, I would be in Columbus. On the second and fourth Sundays, he would be there. And I did that to help Robert through school. And meanwhile, he was a blessing to the church. He was a young preacher, and younger people were more interested in hearing him than they were in hearing me. So this was in January of 1951. And now the workers' meeting in 1951 convened at the Sims Street Church in Atlanta, of which the Bishop James J. Hensley was the minister at that time. In that workers' meeting, we had Bishop C.H. Mason come
And because the Seventh Street Church was small, Bishop Henley succeeded in getting the use of a larger church. I don't remember the name of the church now. Now, the exact street it was on, it was in the Pittsburgh area of Atlanta, where the Seventh Street Church is also located. Not only Bishop Mason, but we had Bishop Williams at that meeting also. That made the workers' meeting of 1951 a great meeting, as had been the workers' meeting in 1950 when Bishop Mason came to Dublin. So 1951, the workers' meeting was at the Sam Street Church. The convocation that year was at the Jones Avenue Church, as it was usually and always until 1970. We would hold a convocation at the Jones Avenue Church each year. 1951 was no exception. Of course, my son Nathan went back to Savannah State College early in 1951, and there he remained until the summer of that year. And the summer of that year, he spent much of the time with me, traveling to Bainbridge and to Columbus and wherever I went. Nathan spent much of his time with me at the close of his freshman year. This is about the high point of 1951, as I recall. I do recall another experience that I had in 1951. It was that year that some pretty stiff opposition surfaced insofar as Northern Georgia was concerned. There were those who went to the room of not my predecessor, but one of the former overseers of Georgia, and they went directly from his room to the office of Bishop Mason and registered an unfounded complaint. And I was able, by the grace of God, as God had told me, when he first gave me the overseership of Georgia, he referred my mind to a passage of scripture, Isaiah 54:17, and I quote, it said, "No weapon that's formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord." So God stood by that promise, and I was able to really break down the testimonies that had been lodged against me. I was able, by the grace of God, to break them down completely, and those who made those accusations got a slight rebuking from Dad Mason. This was a pretty tough experience that I had in the convocation of 1951 that was in Memphis, Tennessee, either the latter part of November or the early part of December. In the year 1952, knowing that that opposition had surfaced, we held the workers' meeting at Albany at the Monroe Street Church of God in Christ. In the meanwhile, we cooked at, I believe it was in the Church and Kingdom of God located on Dorset Avenue. We cooked and ate in their kitchen and dining room during that time. This was a great meeting, and that opposition had stiffened. I had asked, due to my inexperience, I had asked Elder J.E. Bryant to come to that meeting, which he did. And I related to him some of the problems that I had. Fortunately enough, the people who were creating those problems called in to their meeting a person
that they felt was party to those problems, but were not. And that party, of course, informed me what was happening, and I was able to counter that and find a solution for those problems, and God taught me how to do it, and I did. So the workers' meeting in Albany was a very successful meeting, I should think. We would spend 2 hours in prayer each day from 10 o'clock in the morning until 12 noon. We would be on our knees praying to God. There were those who would be off caucusing and planning, but we spent our time before God in prayer. God always gave us a solution to the problem. I remember, too, that my sister Irene from Baxley attended that meeting and was very much inspired. As to the convocation of 1952, the convocation was in Atlanta again at the Jones Avenue Church, and that was a very good and successful convocation. There was an effort in that convocation, however, to embarrass and intimidate the overseer, and it happened that Bishop O.M. Kelly was present in that convocation, and however, God gave us the victory, as he had always done, and as he does now, for which I'm very, very grateful. I remember some of the superintendents of that time, and in fact, I recall all the, really, the names of all of the superintendents of that time. There was a meeting of the superintendents, and they made my son secretary of that meeting. He made a minute of their actions, their purposes, their proposals, and read them to me. After they discovered the mistake, at least what to them was a mistake, but what to me was pertinent and important, they had my son turn the minutes in to them and dismissed him as secretary of that council. But it was too late. He had already read the minutes to me. I knew already what their propositions and proposals were, what their purposes and the intention of intimidating and embarrassing me, and I was able to counter their actions and come almost to the point that the intimidation and embarrassment was reversed. I can look back over the history of my life and ministry and say with the same kind of assurance that David could say, the Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me? I can say like David that he anointeth my head with oil and my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I truly am a witness of the truth of what Jesus said when he said, those that the Father hath given me, none can pluck them out of my hand. Yes, I am a witness that if God be for us, who can be against us? And I'm a witness that God is for and on the side of the righteous. that the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. Yes, I'm a witness that he will suffer you to have no temptation, but such as is common to man, but that he still is faithful and will with the temptation make a way for you to escape so that you will be able to bear it. I remember a song my mother sang when I was a little boy, that the cross is not greater than his grace. The storm cannot hide his blessed face. I am satisfied to know that with Jesus here below, I can conquer every foe. In 1953, we held our state workers' meeting at the Winter Road Church in Columbus. I had an unpleasant experience in that meeting, along with the more pleasant experiences, that I was stopping in the home of a brother and sister Moss, and there was a sister who was expectant. She had a car, and I used her car, and one of the very close superintendents to me and another minister came and raised questions about me driving and using this person's car. This was a very unpleasant experience, but on the other hand, all the other experiences were pleasant ones, and I should even hesitate to point out one unpleasant experience among so many pleasant ones. But that is human nature, and God grant that we learn to forget those more unpleasant, uncomfortable, and embarrassing experiences imposed upon us by men, and remember the glorious and sanctifying and edifying and uplifting experiences not imposed upon us, but by the grace of God given us by God himself. So the workers' meeting of 1953, convening in Columbus, was a very beautiful meeting. Meanwhile, that same year, Elder J.P. Phelps resigned the pastorate of the First Church I had before attempted to establish a pastorate in Atlanta, which was the headquarters of Northern Georgia and still is. The effort had not succeeded, but before the convocation, in fact, in the workers' meeting of 1953, we succeeded in getting Elder Phelps to accept the church at Bainbridge, because the First Church was not succeeding, it was not growing, it was declining, and he accepted the change. So I took over the pastorate of the First Church, and it was established as the headquarters of Northern Georgia. Well, we secured a loan and remodeled the church, put in a new floor, and put in new bathroom facilities, furnished the office with a desk, and there we held the convocation of 1953. That was one of the best convocations we ever held. We held it for 10 days, from Monday of one week to Thursday of the following week. And when we closed that convocation on Thursday night, the saints were shouting the victory and glorifying God as they had done all along.
Not only so, but my daughter, Helen, Sister Klein Hornsby, and Brother William Hornsby, and Robert Smith, along with my son, had planned what we call an institute of study, and it was one of the most beautiful study periods we ever had. My son could play, and they sang Breathe On Me, Breath of God, and then we also had a young man from, I believe, from Turner Theological Seminary, or maybe Marsh Brown College, who could play, and he played for them. It was simply wonderful that year of 1953, and no undercurrent surfaced in that 1953 convocation. It was simply wonderful and beautiful, and my experience was enriched, and God gave favor, at least for a while. There were no surfacing of any kind of undercurrent and any kind of unpleasant situations. And I was grateful, and still am grateful to God for that. Now, we come to 1954. We decided in a call meeting in the early part of 1954 that we would hold the state workers' meeting at Soperton, a church that God had blessed me to preach out in 1927, which I had pastored for 13 years, from 1927 to 1939, I believe it was, or maybe 1940. I believe it was 1940. And we held the workers' meeting at Soperton that year. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience for the people of that area. For a workers' meeting had never convened in that area or in that town before. And everybody was excited. That is, the people of Soperton, the church, the citizenry of the city and county were excited that they were going to have a workers' meeting at their church. And oh, glory to God, it was a wonderful and exhilarating experience. There would be people who would come to the morning prayer services from miles around. And oh, what a time God gave us then and there at that beautiful little church and a little country town. Oh, so it was great and great indeed. Now, in the convocation of 1954, before the convocation, I had a kind of intuitional warning that Satan was really planning, but I did as I always do. I went to God, and I remember well how that on Monday after the third Sunday in July of 1954, which was just 1 month before the convocation, I went down in the woods. Yes, I was still pastoring at Columbus, but I resigned in the convocation of 54. So I went down in the woods to pray. I went down in the woods to pray, as I was wont to do. And it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, and the sky was blue. There were thunderheads over in the sky. They floated lazily through the sky, And the wind was blowing softly through the pine trees. The birds were singing sweetly. And the flowers, the wild flowers were beautiful. And I stood in that spot and looked up toward heaven, began to pray, and suddenly I was caught up in the spirit, and the clouds weren't there anymore, and the sky wasn't blue anymore. The wind wasn't blowing through the trees anymore. The birds were not singing, and the flowers lost their beauty, so far as I'm concerned. And then as I remained in that situation, I don't know how long. The only thing I know is that for a few moments, I was caught up, and I felt the assurance. And in my heart, I began singing, "Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine." And oh, what a foretaste of glory divine, heir of salvation and purchase of God, born of His Spirit and washed in His blood. And I heard that reassuring voice of Jesus saying, "I'm with you, and I'll be with you. I will be with you until the end of the world." Suddenly the birds were singing again. The wind was blowing through the trees again. And the thunderheads were floating lazily through the skies again. All glory be to God. I returned to the house lifted up. I returned to the house inspired, encouraged, enthused, enlightened. Oh, bless His name. I went to the convocation that year. And as I stood in the council and related that story, the glory of God filled the room. And whatever undercurrent might have been attempting to sink it, God stopped it, and it never had the chance of surfacing. Hallelujah to God. That was a year that I flew to Detroit to confer with Bishop Mason about